CliffCentral.com.
Okay, what's happening? CliffCentral.com. Monday morning, it's just after 7 o'clock. I hope you are having an awesome start to your week. And I hope nobody's bothered you and irritated you already. That's all we can hope for. If no one has got in your way, pissed you off, made your day start in a shitty way, then I suppose you can consider yourself fortunate.
That's fair. Start.
Let's start with the small victories. All right, I hope you had a good weekend. We're all back this morning and checking out some of the things going on in the news. It seems like it was mostly a quiet weekend. There wasn't too much craziness going on, except Leanne tells me there was some woman who posed as a photographer on Facebook. And I presume this is in America, not here.
Yeah, it is.
And she was drugging the moms like Bill Cosby, but instead of sexually harassing them like Bill Cosby, she would steal their babies.
Yeah, it's like really bad.
So she would obviously be looking to sell these babies in the black market?
No, she just wanted them for herself.
Oh, so a nutcase.
Yeah,
oh,
absolutely.
Oh.
Juliet Parker, 38, from Washington.
What a ruse, because you say to someone, I'll come around and take baby pictures.
That's what she's been doing. So she's been offering free photo shoots for newborn babies specifically on social media, claiming that she needed to build up her portfolio as a photographer. So she's been accused. Nothing's been proven yet.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently it's claimed that she gave an unsuspecting mum a drugged cupcake during photography sessions that she'd offered for free. She was offering these shoots saying she was an amateur who needed to build up her portfolio. She visited this one mum's house in particular 3 times. The mother told police officers that during the sessions, this woman would take selfies with the baby.
Wow.
Okay.
How weird is that?
She then would also wipe her fingerprints off of items that she touched inside the home. This is what the mum started picking up because there were 3 sessions with her.
Jesus.
During the 3rd session, when she actually visited with her own daughter, who's 16, and she gave the mom a cupcake that made her feel drowsy.
Oy, oy, oy.
So immediately she asked them both to leave. So this woman is now under questioning by police. She also noticed, the mother noticed once this woman had left, that her house keys were missing.
Oh, yeah.
So it seemed like she would have come back.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's an investigation underway.
What a creepy woman, though. I mean, isn't this every parent's worst nightmare? Is that you fall asleep and there's a stranger in your house and you wake up and the stranger's gone with your baby? That has got to be for every parent the most terrifying thing you can imagine.
Huge.
Nothing could be more scary than that.
No.
Wow. So they've locked this woman up, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
The creepiness of it all.
I know. It's a big problem.
Mm.
I hate to say.
Yeah. You hate to say what?
The creep, the killer is all out there. Be careful, folks.
All right. Yeah. Apparently, the price of wine in the US is dropping fast, and nobody's really sure what it is. But it could be happening here soon.
Well, it's happening in California, which is obviously wine country there.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's kind of celebrating. They're like, break out the tumblers. The price of wine's dropping fast.
Yes.
But, I mean, what they're not thinking about is how much money you make as a country from exporting wine.
Mm-hmm.
And we as South Africans know that very well.
But have they figured out why the price
is
dropping? Ah, okay.
It's due to a surplus of California grapes.
Oh.
So what's been happening is a lot of people are turning to the trends, which is the gins and the new cane that's, you know, home-brewed and crafted cane and gins. So apparently it's just like a trend thing, really.
All right. So what does that mean? That it's going to reverse so that it'll keep going? Because obviously I think most people want cheaper wine because, my God, some wine is very expensive. But you also do get the stuff right at the bottom end of the scale that, you know, that's...
I just don't think, I think South Africans love their wine too much.
You think? You don't think Americans do? California, man, do they love them? We love some wine.
Yeah. They just seem to be turning to cocktails and these ready-made type drinks.
I think I used a Texan accent there.
That went a little southern there.
Am I, oh my God, like we've got to get some wine.
Yeah.
It's more like California.
And then it went a bit New York at the end.
Wine.
Wine. How you doing?
Okay, all right. Shut up.
Okay, let's focus on the story. Right. The point is...
Douchebag. Get in here on Monday morning and start giving me shit straight away.
So I think the idea is perhaps we should look at buying California wine online.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe you can get a good deal.
Yeah, and then and your courier will then charge you so much more to bring it in.
And then the exchange rate.
Yeah, and then you'll eventually go, oh, well, this cost me way more than if I just go into the store down the road.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. There's other stuff that we need to know about this Monday morning. And you can always get hold of us if you want on 079-748-2090. Let us know what's on your mind. Here's an interesting story. There's this South African student that they found alive, but in prison in China.
Yeah.
Apparently we thought that this person was missing.
So, yeah, the South African student, Alpha Mbecheni, went to China with a bunch of his friends. And he went missing. And everyone's been really worried about this. And his family have had no communication. His family were alerted to his disappearance by the friends. They were leaving China and then going to go to Bangkok in Thailand. So he's been found now, but he's in jail. And that's all these parents know. They are being left in the dark completely by the Chinese government.
Sure.
They thought, oh my God, he's got coronavirus and he's died. So they're really relieved that he is alive. But I mean, I wonder
how those Chinese prisons are.
They're not being monitored, I'm sure, for that.
When did he go to China? Are we talking? Is this like he lived like 4 years ago and now?
No, a month ago. More than a month ago.
That's still long enough to go, oh my goodness.
Yeah. No, there's something dodgier happening here. And the friends know what's going on.
I think it might be a drug thing.
Yeah, you can't lose a friend, an actual human being, like you've lost a pen somewhere.
Yeah.
You must know, were they at the hotel with you? Did they get into the same shuttle to the airport? Did they not make it to the airport? I would question those friends.
I agree. Yeah. It's not like you were at a braai with your friend. Oh, well, she got a little drunk. We left her there sleeping on the couch.
No.
You were in China. Like you left
you
someone in
friends
China.
Sleeping on the sofa in a stranger's house?
Yeah, it's all my problem. If you're
nice friend you are.
I'm going home.
Write that one down on the list of things he hates, his friends.
Clearly.
What am I doing? Babysitting. But you're in China, right? You're not leaving a friend in China like, oopsie. Like, it's not leaving your wallet at your cousin's house.
Yeah,
like CS said.
All right, very important. Is Leanne going to be giving us any updates on The New Bachelor South Africa? This is a very good point made by Wendell.
I started watching it. I never finished it.
Yeah, because it's 90 minutes long.
It's really crazy.
I was busy this weekend.
Actually sent everybody a message to say, watch The Bachelor.
Yeah, so I reckon I got halfway through, because remember, it's now everyone arriving, it's the red carpet, it's the first cocktail ceremony, introducing to everyone, learning about him. It's really like long, but I really like him. I must say, I don't have anything negative to say about him.
So he seems like a nice guy.
Yeah.
All right.
The girls, on the other hand, there's going to be some cattiness this year.
Yeah.
Are they all scary?
Ooh. Yeah, there's definitely some bitchiness going on. So that'll be the ones calling her typical Joburg puppy.
Awesome.
The ones not drinking alcohol and the others suddenly, are raising their eyebrows.
You've given me a reason to watch. I think I'm going to have to see what's going on over there. Is anybody we know?
No, no one that I know personally.
Because remember last time we knew some people.
Yeah. Me neither. No one I know, yeah.
But also, it's going quickly. It went quickly, the introduction. So maybe if I see their names again, I'll recognize someone.
I was amazed by a story of the weekend that I think we should just unpack a little bit today. The EFF, one of the things that they were so unhappy about in Parliament on Thursday, if you remember, was that F.W. de Klerk was there. Now, it's not unusual for former presidents to be at the State of the Nation address. In fact, the only former president who wasn't there and was conspicuous by his absence was Thabo Mbeki. And Jacob Zuma wasn't there this time either because he's supposedly very ill, although nobody believes that. So the only former president who is still alive who could be there is F.W. de Klerk, and he was sitting there in the balcony. Now, you've got to have some appreciation for the history of South Africa to understand why it's important that he's there. Remember, he was part of the government of national unity. Forget the fact that he was part of the nationalist government and that he unbanned the ANC and that he brought them to the negotiating table with the ANC and that he was very much part of our negotiated settlement in this country. That negotiated settlement is something that we've all come to criticize for various reasons since then. Some people think that it was not negotiated successfully enough by the ANC or that it was negotiated too successfully by the ANC, depending on who you speak to. However, it is history. That is water under the bridge, as they say. And F.W. de Klerk, as a former deputy president of South Africa post-94, is invited, but he's also invited as a former president pre-94. So it was right that he was there. It's not unusual. It's cheap point scoring by the EFF. F.W. de Klerk's foundation has, in the meantime, said some things which are controversial about how he doesn't think apartheid was a, what is it?
Crime against humanity.
Right. Yeah, there's been no actual apology or anything from him, or admission.
Again, this was part of the negotiated settlement, is that people would come forward, they would tell their stories. Some people did, some people didn't. We had former Defense Minister Magnus Malan, who conspicuously then did not feel he needed to come to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. There were other people who also decided they didn't want to come. And F.W. de Klerk's negotiation was, look, we're going to change the way this country's run. We're going to become a proper democracy. We're going to unban the ANC. And then as a part of that arrangement, certain things are going to kick in. Like there's some sort of an immunity for former cabinet ministers and people who did bad things as long as they unburden themselves. That was the whole Truth and Reconciliation Commission thing. And what people failed to realize is that if you just pick up one short book on South African history, you can update yourself on all of this. Now, whether F.W. de Klerk thinks apartheid was a crime against humanity or not, it should first of all be obvious to anyone that he's not going to claim that that is the case, because that makes him a criminal. You don't indict yourself. That's obvious to anybody who's willing to pick up any legal textbook. Second thing is, who cares what he thinks? If the UN has decided it's a crime against humanity, it's a crime against humanity. Do you want him to agree with you so much that it is unacceptable to you that he and his foundation do not? Why not just let it go? This is a man you already have said you disagree with politically, if you're in the EFF. Why would it bother you that he doesn't agree with you? You don't agree with him as a founding principle of your party, as is the case with all three of the major parties in Parliament. The three major parties in Parliament are agreed that apartheid was a terrible thing, as are most South Africans. Even most white South Africans, which is why in the referendum, most of them voted yes. This is going back to 1992, before we had a democratically elected government. So let's all stop bullshitting ourselves. Everybody doesn't have to agree with you, and you can't force everybody to agree with you. So if F.W. de Klerk doesn't agree with you, so what?
Having said that, I think when you say things like that, you know, I couldn't imagine going to Germany and anybody saying that Hitler's crimes weren't a crime against humanity, and that being okay in any public sphere. So
absolutely,
this is a
different situation, because he has not been put in the Nuremberg trial docks and hanged. It was a negotiated settlement. Part of the negotiated settlement is we let bygones be bygones in certain areas and we move forward.
Sure. And Germany experienced what they call a silent generation. Sure, I can accept that. But, you know, part of free speech is dealing with the repercussions of what you say. So you don't just get to say what you want to say. And saying things like that, I'm afraid, it's going to have a different impact if it's affected your life. So when you say things like that in this country and you're still alive, I'm afraid there has to be backlash for that.
And this is exactly why there is a backlash, and I get it. But the idea that you want him to agree with your point of view is crazy. He's never going to. That's like me saying to Julius, for example, you have to respect property rights. He's never going to agree with me. He doesn't want to respect property rights. But it's an argument that makes us different. And the desire for us to be the same should be measured with a little bit of understanding that someone is not going to agree with you.
But I think to say something like that is heinous. To me, it's absolutely heinous to utter that.
So what do you expect from him?
Well,
former apartheid president. I mean, what do you expect? It's more stupid that you're surprised that he doesn't say that.
No, sure, that doesn't make it okay, and it doesn't mean he shouldn't be chastised. So, of course, definitely,
and of course, there's going to be a lot of this is not going away, right?
Yeah,
because there's political capital to be made here.
Yeah, that's,
and the EFF are not stupid. They're like, well, if we can blame this on him and we can get him out in the newspapers, it makes us look like heroes. Easy point scoring, because the real villain in the world right now for most people is municipal government
and Prince Andrew.
Good point, and yes, Prince
good old Andy.
Andrew. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the new cheap buzz term to make them seem like they're doing more than they are, right?
Yeah, it's grabbing some free virtue points. Sure.
Yeah, if it's not land, it can be this. And that's why he's still even, de Klerk is trending even right now. So,
and I do get that. I mean, I totally understand.
It's the only time de Klerk and trend has been put in the same sentence.
I'm glad you're in the studio, Mbulelo. There we go, you see? Some people agree with you, Sandile, saying that's a very good point you make. And it is. But I love the fact that there are still people in the world who think that you're going to agree with them if they just put you under enough pressure. It's 2020, not everybody will, and that's actually a good thing. Then you can pick your side, your team, your the people that you want to support, and you can go with them. All right? I see Michael Bloomberg is surging in the polls in America at the moment. He seems to be doing a huge amount in terms of fundraising. He's got $1.8 million in the last day and a half into his...
$1.8 million?
Yeah. Has just been... No, I mean, he's a billionaire, so that's nothing to him.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's just been in the last day. Seems that his daily breakdown. Not bad, huh?
Yeah.
It's just a delightful time in American politics. So one of the things I was... surprise.
In one day, that's what he spent, $1.8 million on Facebook ads in one day. That's what he spent, not what he raised. Yeah. That's what he spent.
Oh, yeah, then that's nothing to him.
Yeah, that's like the interest in his bank account every minute.
Sure.
But then watch other people get really jealous.
Oh, for sure.
Everyone else who had to drop
I'm
out.
I'm not a billionaire, it's not fair. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Just
all right.
Calm down. You know, I was surprised yesterday to see, you know, some people comment on the car that President Trump used.
Yes, the Beast.
So he rolled up to NASCAR's Daytona 500 yesterday in his limousine, the Beast. And people were so surprised by how it looked and the fact that he did half a ride around the track about it. But I started Googling more about the Beast and I was surprised to find out about like how much it's tricked out. So this Beast, it's a standard for a president to use, or a similar version is quite a standard for a president to use. The car is tricked out and valued at $1.5 million. It only seats 7 people and it weighs about 20,000 pounds.
Yeah, it's a huge vehicle.
That's a very heavy
armored
car.
I mean, the doors, if you see in pictures, the doors are like 2 bricks thick.
Listen to some of the specs that this car has.
The Beast.
The door does close with a bit of a clank.
Yeah.
So the car now, as Trump is president, comes fully loaded with bags of the president's blood type. I did not know that. Yeah, so should anything happen to the president, you can start operating, or I don't know, like if you ever need a blood transfusion. Yeah, right there and then. It also can spew out a smoke screen. It can also spew out fire tear gas. And it also has a dispenser for oil. So should they be involved in a car chase or something and they need to get
some oil.
What in the Tom Cruise movies going on here?
That is crazy.
Fascinating. It also has at least 8-inch thick walls and at least 5-inch multi-layer windows that make the doors as heavy as those of a Boeing 757 jet.
And it's eco-friendly.
Sure. Clearly it is. So you think, you know, he can casually drive around a racetrack and you think
that's all of it. Well, he did. I think he took the Beast down the racetrack there at like 100 miles an hour. Which is probably the fastest it's gone, with his little flags waving in the wind.
He's so corny.
He is so corny, but he also flew Air Force One in at very low level. And the crowd loved it. NASCAR!
Woohoo! Donald Trump!
But he's playing to his base. That is very clever PR.
So it got me actually researching and about the most protected people in the world. Mm-hmm. And President Trump, understandably, is part of that top 10 most protected people in the world. You won't be surprised by some of the other people who are on this list, but the extent in which they go to protect themselves is quite surprising. So part of that top 10 is Mark Zuckerberg. He is undoubtedly the most protected CEO in the world. So he spends about $20 million a year on security alone. That excludes $7.3 million that is spent on his bodyguards.
What are the threats here that they're facing? They're facing some lunatic in the crowd who might shoot them.
Are they
facing kidnapping threats?
You never know.
I love these people who are really not well known to any of us who walk around with bodyguards. You get them here in South Africa occasionally. Mm-hmm. You'll see like someone who's either they're a politician or they're some foreign dignitary's children, or and they always have like three or four bodyguards. And you think, well, that is exactly what makes you a target. Your bodyguards are the reason people are looking at you. It's the reason someone would know you had come.
Sure.
If you just walked in and chilled and you had a cap on and sunglasses, no one would know it was you.
But I've heard of like some taxi bosses who have bodyguards even.
But that's different. They're gangsters.
Yeah.
Taxi bosses. that's what gangsters need, right?
Right.
Taxi bosses are gangsters.
For sure. Them and soccer owners.
Yeah.
Good point. But also, Leanne, I think it's bracing yourself and protecting yourself from anything out there. Mm. I don't think they're like, oh, yeah, there's so-and-so, this gang out to get me. I think you never know. It could be some freak who's trying to get into your house. Apart from the beast, if we're going back to President Trump, of course, he has the Air Force One, the most secure aircraft in the world. He also has spent over $16 million just in upgrading some of the security details since he came into the White House. And in May of 2017, a federal budget was released, which included $120 million for an entire year for the security of him and his family.
Why does Zuckerberg need all that security? Yeah. Dude, you're some nerd. No one wants to be you. Like, if I'm Cristiano Ronaldo, maybe somebody wants to be. Zucks, relax.
Who wants to kill Zuckerberg? Consider, like, kidnapping him?
No, he's a nerd. He's like a loser. Like, I love Facebook.
You're both being silly now. This guy's a billionaire, a multi-billionaire. We've seen pictures of his wife and him on innumerable social media websites and on TV channels and magazines and newspapers and everywhere. If you were a crook who wanted to get $1 billion, you would kidnap his child. And people do these kinds of things. There's a level of security when you're at that magnitude of wealth. You have to employ. There are nutcases out there. They will think that if they can just steal something precious enough to you, you'll pay them any amount of money because you have so much.
And even just money aside, there are proper crazies out there who might be so pissed off at how Facebook is sending adverts to, yes, and so they just want to go out and shank Mark Zuckerberg.
Right.
Well, in most lists that I saw, the number one most protected person in the world is President Vladimir Putin. And he's so protected that only assumptions can truly be made by how intense his security is. So he is basically protected by the Federal Protective Service, which is the state protection in Russia. But on top of that, he has his own security team that goes into the thousands. There are some reports that say easily he has about more than 1,000 plainclothes officers around the country who travel in the likes of armored cars, who have drones, and who even are part of a dedicated psychological security team who protect him.
Wow.
Putin is.
I think he would be hard to kill.
I don't want to actually mess with him. Let him be. Let him ride on the horses. Let him ride shirtless, but don't try to do anything with that. But yeah, it was. This is the rabbit hole I was stuck reading and researching up on this weekend. Some weird protection styles going on in the world.
Well, apparently there's a 200,000 rand reward for the recovery of a 4 million rand Lamborghini.
In Bedford View.
Well, of course, in Bedford View. Where else would they have a Lamborghini?
It's a Millennium Drive there. Bedford View.
And how do you hide a Lamborghini?
It's a Lamborghini Urus. So it's one of those big 4x4 guys.
Oh, God, those are revolting.
So that's been stolen, and there's a reward of 200,000 Rand for information leading to its recovery.
Yeah.
So they really want this car back. Would you pay?
Not a chance.
200,000 Rand?
over and above the price of an already $4 million.
When you've,
who is it? The insurance company?
Yeah, I was going to say, surely they had insurance.
Yeah, but is the insurance company offering the reward? Maybe that's
no,
it.
No, it's the owner.
Oh. He's putting it out there for the guys.
Yeah.
I want to
know.
Back.
We need to know more about this owner.
No, we don't. He's in Bedford View. We know what it's like. And he lives on Millionaire Drive.
Also, a Lamborghini 4x4, please.
So if you...
If I saw that, I would tell them. I'd say, here, you have your cough.
Well, now, listen. This is quite good news for all of us because we need to look out for this car. Because if you spot it,
you're
going to get
yourself
200,000 rand. Yeah. Okay.
All right, so go on.
So the registration plate is...
Oh, we can actually take notes?
Yeah.
Oh, take notes, everybody. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The registration plate is JD, so the opposite of DJ, you think of that.
Okay,
all
right.
Okay, 89... Uh-huh. 8 and 9, ZJ, Zoll joint, GP.
This is how Leanne remembers.
I do.
JD.
My number plate
JD
is
8 9 Zoll joint, ZJ. Okay.
I have to remember things like that. My number plate is fuck sakes, I'm 53, bitches.
All right, so now you know.
You'll say that one day when you're like filling out an official document or something.
Amazing. Okay.
So yeah, look out for that.
And you can make some dumb.
And it's what?
What?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, very good. False. De Klerk and Trend were not in the same sentence plenty. Oh, they were plenty in the same sentence when Fuff wore that Speedo. good point.
Okay.
That was when it was really trending. The Beast sounds like something out of Dastardly and Muttley's Wacky Races. Well, the Beast is Donald Trump's car. It was Obama's car before.
Mm.
It's a hell of a heavy thing, that.
But Obama's just a Mac Daddy.
Yeah. Obama is a Mac Daddy. Sia never gives his opinion on these political issues. What does he think of de Klerk's utterance? Do you want to give an opinion on that?
Mm.
Or are you not going to have a gun put to your head?
Doesn't change the price of my bread, no.
That's a very sensible point of view, actually.
Fair enough.
Oh. This guy had checks of him and his new wife printed so he could write alimony checks to his ex. But the check, the background of the check, has pictures of him and his new wife all over it.
Oh, no.
That's awesome.
Yes. Oh, no.
Is that a South African?
No, I think it's in America.
They only still use checks in America.
But we spoke of petty people last week, and this is just so great. So
are they embracing, like, in a central position with it?
Yeah, it's the two of them looking really happy, and then
like
on their
Instagram
wedding
Instagram-type photos.
Yeah, and they basically want whoever the new wife or the old wife is to be upset every time she sees these pictures.
That's excellent.
Hilarious. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it has been a couple of years since I last saw this guy. It's ridiculous, actually, all things considered. But Khan has been busy. He's been celebrating the past 2 decades of the Parlatones. He's launched his eponymous Khan, found time to successfully coach 2 winners in the reality TV singing competition, The Voice, and things have gotten busier for him. Also, more rewards when he went back to school with Henley Business School. We'll find out all about that. It's time for Meet the Minds. That's right. We're on the final episode of Meet the Minds this morning, and we get to spend a bit of time catching up with Khan, which is going to be very exciting. Here's something for you to listen to first. Henley Business School's Africa Connect alumni platform was launched in November 2019, and the opening event brought together some of the school's most prominent students and graduates. Khan Morbi is better known as the frontman of one of South Africa's most well-loved indie rock bands, the Parlatones. He's been in the music business for 20 years, and as a veteran, he understands the value of the right qualifications for the job. But we wanted to know if he thought a person could be overqualified.
If you treat learning as just part of the journey of life, definitely not. I mean, I don't think we will ever learn everything there is to learn. Doesn't matter how many lifetimes you live. I do think what universities have done is they've spewed out like a plethora of nonsensical degrees and diplomas that may not necessarily result in a career path. But I think just because you study the arts or you study drama doesn't necessarily mean that those skills would be lost in a corporate environment. So all learning has validity. I think learning should be a lifelong journey, and if that dubs you overqualified, well, it's not a bad label to be called.
This is Meet the Mind, the series that gives you insight into some of South Africa's most interesting thinkers, brought to you by Henley Business School. Yes, indeed. Pleasure to see you, my friend. How are you?
I'm well, and how are you?
Good. Khan Morby, look at you. You don't look a single day older than the last time I saw you, so obviously you're doing something right.
I like how vague that is.
No, are you still touring?
You're probably thinking 50.
No, because I know what the touring, man, that takes it out of you.
I'm definitely still touring. Yeah.
As much?
Well, I try and be more balanced now. I've got kids.
Yeah,
I think they take it more out of me than touring does.
Really? Kids are harder work than being a rock star.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So you've obviously kept up all of that while you're studying, but I think this is amazing. Found out that you were one of the students who's doing their MBA at Henley. Some interesting people that we've met over the last few days. We've met... last week was Loiso, Polly van Wyk. We met John Flismus. We've sat down with some really interesting people who are doing these MBAs at Henley. Now, what pulled you into that world?
I think it was just serendipity. I kind of met John, the dean, maybe 5 years ago, mm-hmm. Just by chance. We were both flying somewhere internationally and kind of spoke about life in general and... exchange numbers, and at the beginning of this year I kind of wanted to start looking at doing a whole bunch of short courses and stuff that might interest me, like for example graphic design or whatever.
Yeah.
Just something that I feel could enhance my skill set.
Sure.
And he just phoned me out of the blue and I was like, and said, you know, would you be interested in doing some further studies at Henley? And I was like, oh, well, you know, this, you know, it's kind of pulling me in that direction. I was going to do short courses, but I guess I'll do a long academic course. And I said, yeah, why not? You know, give it a bash.
Did you feel at that stage like it was going to be a major time commitment, that it was something you were going to have to take seriously and so you couldn't really mess around here? And maybe you'd bitten off more than you could chew?
Yeah, 100%. And I think the whole dilemma, even when I was filling out the application form, which was quite a process in itself, I was like, crumbs, what am I getting into? And I think the hardest thing for me is to go, you know, obviously my major passion is writing songs, and I was like, is this gonna detract from that and deviate from that? Which it has, certainly. But
writing songs, are you one of those people who can sit down and go, okay, now I'm gonna write, and you sit there with, you know, keyboards, guitars, whoever else, and whatever else you need. Maybe you've got just the song in your head, and you're just sitting humming it to yourself. I don't know. Do you set aside time, and that time always ends up being productive? I mean, is it like people say, if you need to write a book, you just write, and a lot of it will be crap, and you can throw it away later. But if you don't actually get to writing and discipline yourself to just write for an hour every day, you'll never get anything done. Is music like that for you?
At some part of the process, yes. You know, if I'm actually start to legitimately document it. But there's a lot of nonsensical voice notes and musings.
You're telling me it can come to you at any time?
Yeah, 100%, yeah. But at some stage, you've got to take that chaos and collate it into...
See, that's the part of writing songs that people like me don't understand, is that there's a genius component, a spark of inspiration component, divine stuff. That's like, oh my God, this melody, right? Of which you've written many. And then there's the part where you have to sit and actually hammer it into a song. And that's much more boring and hard.
Yeah, well, that starts to make it... formalized and I mean that's the analogy that I've kind of my approach to this whole MBA thing is I approach an assignment like I would a song. You know, you kind of, a song is all this theory that floats around, or music is, it's all these, you know, it's coupled with experience and all of that stuff, but at some stage you've got to collate it into a digestible format that makes sense to yourself and obviously to a potential audience. An assignment is very similar. It's, you know,
you know who the audience are, you know what you've got to do.
Yeah.
So what is yours about? What is the subject of your thesis?
I haven't decided yet. I'm still in stage one.
Okay.
I'm about to write my exams.
Do you have any inkling to what you might want to do?
I think I mean obviously it's got to kind of sort of revolve around business, the business world. And I'd love to merge my world, which is being a creative, into that sort of world.
There's a lot of subject matter there that's very interesting to people in business now.
Yeah, I think, you know, generally in the business world, I think there seems to be a focus on core skills rather than those other skills that kind of make you successful in the business space, like being creative.
Well, I mean, don't you have a unique kind of experience there that very few people actually understand as well as you do? I'm referring to the fact that you managed to make the Parlor Tones, not just you, obviously, there were other people involved too, but you guys were a tremendously successful band that managed to extend your brand into areas that maybe other bands just never thought of. You were in commercials, you had a wine. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff that you guys did that was really very clever, very creative, broke through in a number of ways at a time in music where most people were lost because they couldn't sell the music the way they used to, and performances everyone was doing. You did different stuff. Isn't that an obvious place to go?
Yeah, maybe.
New business.
Maybe in hindsight.
New revenue streams for music businesses.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think I'd just frame it as hustling.
Yeah, sure. But hustling, isn't that all business?
100%. Yeah.
I mean, I think that this is a very exciting thing for you to be able to do because you could teach the rest of us some stuff.
Look, I'm very, very excited about it. And it's, you know, the more I kind of unwrap this MBA journey, I do start applying it to, you know, the business of music.
Right.
And yeah, it's also from a personal side, there's great development there. And I often wonder, like I say, I wish I'd kind of gone on this journey maybe 10 years ago, but I don't know. You know, I almost feel like I needed to do the organic journey of,
right,
of learning through mistakes. And now in hindsight to go, you know, you get this sort of aha moment. I don't know what that means going forward. Because maybe if I'd done this 10 years ago, I'd be like, definitely don't do music.
Oh. But how's your life different now? You mentioned the kids and all of that kind of thing. You know, 10 years ago, you guys were probably doing a gig every other night, and that's probably still going on in some way, shape, or form. But things do change. People do start to have different priorities. Now you're studying as well. How are the other guys in the band? What's been happening? Give us a little update.
Yeah.
Kind of bullshit that you have to tell someone when you see them at a braai. Go.
Yeah, we're still busy. We still manage to tour once a year abroad. Mm-hmm. We try and do two or three tours locally. We're all more balanced. We all have children except for Glenn. So I think what we've got better at doing is saying no.
Yeah.
Which I think you learn as you get older is you don't have to say yes and agree to everything. It's more, does this make sense? It's not always about money.
It's such a nice phase of your life to be in.
Yeah, exactly.
Not continuously chasing.
And to be comfortable with it. Because often there's this fear of offending. You know, if I say no, are they going to dislike me? Or are they going to...
Or a fear of missing out, which is even worse.
Oh, no. Well, I still have that.
You do? Yeah, oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've had that throughout my career. Just from... And there's the trade-off, you know, if we'd play so often that you'd often miss out on weddings or birthdays.
Oh, right. Okay, I got you. That makes sense.
Yeah, so...
And you have probably missed a ton of those because you've been busy, you've been performing.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, because you're working hardest when everyone else is taking it easy, you know?
Exactly, yeah. Well, we work on the weekends and we work at night when everyone's kind of having a jol.
Right. Okay, so that's all going on. Tell me about the family life. Tell me about that, how that's changed everything for you too.
Yeah, you know, I think up until now you kind of live a very selfish existence. And for the longest time, I think I didn't want kids for that reason. But then they come and it completely changes your perspective. and I'm very grateful that I have them. And
yeah, I was about to say, can't you on selling as well? I didn't want kids. 100%. Huh? And then they go.
No, I mean, they bring a lot of joy
now
to me.
I have to deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not like a hobby you can put back in the cupboard. I'm tired of this hobby. So, But yeah, it is a big decision, you know, especially if your existence up until then is kind of been quite self-fulfilling.
Yeah.
You know, and now it changes your whole world, really. You go, okay, now it's not just...
But it's also about, like, adding layers, right? I mean, you can't just keep moving in the same lane forever. Eventually, you're going to know everything about that lane as it circles round. Kids are an aspect of this. And then, obviously, studying something like an MBA is another part of this. Are you currently running other businesses while you're doing your MBA and while you're performing and while you're parenting? Or is that enough on one person's plate?
Well, what I try to do is kind of find as many passive investments.
Sure.
You know, what I've done over the years is I've acquired a lot of properties.
Okay.
Maybe not such a wise choice in
current
context.
Sure, it's probably costing you a little bit now, but then,
yeah.
And if you're trying to sell them now, it's a disaster, right?
No, exactly, yeah. So, well, you know, there's a lot of sort of negative sentiment about owning property, I guess.
Sure. But that's clever if you've got rentals.
No, 100%. They're all rental properties, and I've been very lucky that I've had hardly any problems. You know.
So are you telling me that someone could hire a place for business or for residential purposes, and you might be their landlord?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Imagine you go to the meeting with a landlord, and it's Khan. You're like, Jesus.
Well, yeah. I'll pay someone to do that for me.
Yeah, because I was going to say...
You didn't go to any of those meetings.
No. I was going to say, because if my landlord was Khan, and he was calling me about... music or noise complaints, I'd be like, really?
You're telling me
I should be keeping quiet. Yeah, it's not the same.
Right, well, unlike many other business schools that offer a linear experience that force feeds theory to people, Henley Business School offers a holistic learning system. They blend theory with practice, and they have a system which means you can look forward to a business education that provides you with an insightful acumen, the ability to master yourself and lead and manage others, an exceptionally relevant and practical theory that is tried and trusted in your own workplace. So they've got 15 international campuses and offices, 8,000 students across the globe, 18 countries represented by faculty, and 78,000 alumni in their network. Your MBA can take you places. And Henley has the only MBA from international business schools accredited in South Africa. As your MBA is from a leading, respected, internationally triple accredited business school, you get recognized wherever you are in the world, ensuring your global future. I mean, you've met some of these other people who are at Henley, right? There's some really smart people there.
Yes, I think that was also one of the things that was very intimidating for me initially, is kind of going to these workshops with people that, you know, had academic prowess and obviously, I guess, the business acumen and experience.
Yeah. Was it intimidating? Because they were probably intimidated to have a rock star in the room.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, different from a different context, it's intimidating. From a, you know, you kind of feel like, you know, I'm the sort of class clown. From a, you know, I'm the joke, the jester, kind of.
Most of them are like, oh, fuck, I wish I could be cool like that guy sitting in the back of the class.
Yeah, so, but yeah, I think you kind of realize that everyone comes into these things with their own sort of anxiety or baggage that they might, you know, bring into it.
What would be the ideal outcome from this for you? I mean, what's one of the reasons you're doing it? Is it just a cool thing to be able to say you've done? Is it about self-improvement, which you've already indicated? Is it about being able to launch successful business ventures after this and be able to really comprehend what's going on in business in a way that it leads to money? Which of those is it, or is it all?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question I asked, because, you know, I've always loved learning, and generally it's been through reading books, and I was like, why am I doing this? Is it an ego thing? Just to say, and I have this piece of paper that says I've done an MBA. I don't know. I think I'll find that out on the journey. I guess in some regard it'd be nice to marry the core skills that I have, which is sort of being a musician and all of that jazz, with this world of business. What that turns out to be, I don't think studying an MBA suddenly makes you an entrepreneur, or suddenly makes you businessman of the year, or results in you going, ah, now I know exactly what I'm going to do with this document. I think maybe in some regard it is some sort of ego thing to go, you know, I'm spending all this time learning anyway. I'm reading all these books.
And maybe as well get the credit for it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe focused learning, because often I have, like, I'm reading 5 books.
What kind of books do you read? I mean, is it stuff about what's practically related to the course, or is it just stuff that interests you from all kinds of areas?
More that. So it'll, you know, be books on science or history. Right. Most recently, I've kind of finished the trilogy of that Yuval Noah Harari.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, yeah. Sapiens, Homo Deus, and 21 Rules. Yeah. Smart guy, that.
Yeah, very smart guy. And writes very, you know, it's palatable.
Yeah, totally. I just admire the ability he has to condense everything into.
Yeah, make it
simple ideas. Yeah. It's terrific.
Yeah, and before that, I kind of, you know, I've read a lot of stuff from Richard Dawkins. Mm-hmm. You know, which is sometimes, I guess, controversial.
And for some people, yeah.
Yeah, yes. And but you know, from a scientific point of view, he does the same.
Yeah, he's a very interesting dude.
Yeah. And then Bill Bryson wrote a really good book called, A Short History of Nearly Everything. It was kind of Sapiens before Sapiens.
Yeah.
And it was really good. He's got A Short History of the Home, which is also fascinating.
Yeah.
Apparently, he's got a new one out.
Great writer, that guy.
Yeah, great writer, yeah.
So this is sounding like someone who's just curious about the world too. I mean, you almost could be the kind of person who would do this without accreditation, but it's nice to be given something in return for the years of study that you're putting in.
Exactly, yeah. I might as well.
It's very nice.
And maybe it's focused learning.
It sounds like you've got everything in perfect balance at the moment. Maybe you could teach the rest of us, because I somehow feel like I'm not doing enough.
Yeah.
I don't think we ever have perfect balance, you know. I think if you have perfect balance, maybe you're not doing enough. But I think it's about getting to that point of equilibrium and then going, okay, you know, how can I unbalance myself again?
Brilliant. Well, that's exactly what we got you here to do, to tell us some of those things. And that's probably the most valuable lesson of them all, is once you start feeling like you're too balanced, it's time to kick things up a level.
Exactly.
Well, Con, nice to see you, dude.
Cool.
And very cool to have a conversation about things other than just music and performing and touring and all the other stuff. You're doing any TV at the moment?
No.
No.
No, no.
I get over that quickly, right?
Yeah. Sure, that's it.
I think I tried to tell you that. Anyway,
took you a bit longer than me.
Very good to see you. Exactly. Yeah. Very good to see you, though, dude. And thank you so much for popping by. This is Meet the Minds. It's brought to you by Henley Business School. It is cliffcentral.com at 8:09. Coming up in a moment, Decrypto, episode 12. Meet the Mind. Brought to you by Henley Business School. Only on cliffcentral.com.
When people talk about cryptocurrency, Bitcoin in particular, there's always a comment about crazy fluctuations in price. But cryptocurrency is an investment tool, and just like any other investment, there are things that will affect its value. We've come to Luno HQ in Cape Town, where Luno Africa's GM, Marius Reitz, explains a few factors that might impact the crypto market.
There are a couple of things that impact the price. I think firstly, it's important to just say that there's no standard or there's no global Bitcoin price. Bitcoin isn't pegged to the US dollar or to any country for that matter. The price is ultimately impacted by supply and demand forces on each exchange, on each country. And that is similar to how the price of sneakers would be determined. If there's a high demand for a new sneaker, then that manufacturer will then obviously increase that price. So the price split on Luno is unique. And that's simply because of supply and demand on Luno, set by buyers and sellers on Luno, and that's unique from other exchanges. There is, however, a trend, so the price would never differ or fall outside of 5 to 10% price difference if you compare that to the prices trading on exchanges in Europe, for example, Bitstamp or Coinbase in the United States. But what impacts the supply and demand? I think that's an important question. So as I said earlier, the more people wanting to buy something, then that will effectively push up the price. And then again, if you have more people wanting to sell Bitcoin or any other good for that matter, that will then obviously then drive down the price. But Bitcoin is notorious for its volatile price. Does this mean that it's fickle or that it's a scam? No, certainly not. It just has some unusual features. Firstly, the price of Bitcoin is often linked to news items, rumors, or misinformation. Firstly, regulatory action or announcements. So if a central bank somewhere around the world announces that they plan to regulate Bitcoin in one specific way, then that might impact the price. Large investment firms entering the market, taking positions in Bitcoin, for example, Fidelity, corporates like Facebook, for example, announcing their new Libra project, that can certainly impact the price. South Africa, however, isn't immune to international news or international rumors or misinformation. For example, if the SEC in the United States decide to approve a Bitcoin ETF, then the price change will also be seen in South Africa. And that is because Bitcoin is a global currency. A lot of the liquidity coming into South Africa comes from foreign markets, and that is why the circulation is global and not linked to only certain markets. And then I think also importantly, security hacks. So if there's a security breach on a well-known platform and Bitcoin is being stolen or lost, that has an impact on the reputation of the industry, and that more often than not will then have a negative impact on the price. Secondly, Bitcoin is a new technology. A new technology is always goes through a distinct hype cycle. Bitcoin is young. It's only been around since 2009. The first phase of this hype cycle usually is when only a few people know about this. The second phase is where over time, gradually, people will become aware of it. Everyone's talking about it, and hype becomes ridiculous, and that is what we saw in 2017 and early 2018 when the price rallied from $2,000 to $3,000 to ultimately reach a high of $20,000. Then thirdly, the inevitable drop sets in, the price falls, and then lastly, behind the scenes, the technology continues to improve. There's more platforms available. It's becoming easier for people to buy cryptocurrency with their own. There's better education in the market. Regulators start to form their views and their opinions, and cryptocurrency becomes a productive part of our lives. Price is the obvious public sign of where Bitcoin is in the hype cycle. And if you look at other technologies, other companies for that matter, like Facebook or any other technology business, you will see that that company went through the same hype cycle and the share price of the company followed a similar trajectory. Thirdly, I think is limited liquidity. So there's limited liquidity in the cryptocurrency market. This essentially refers to how easy it is to buy or sell something without changing its price. And just maybe to put it into context, if you look at a company like Naspers, being traded on the JSE, they have a market capitalization of approximately $65 billion. Bitcoin's market capitalization across the world globally is only $154 billion. So that puts it into perspective that the Bitcoin is still young, liquidity is still fairly on the low side, although it is increasing on a monthly basis. So if someone tries to buy a lot of Bitcoin, there's not enough Bitcoin available in the market at that specific price, and that will then more often than not push down the price. And then also vice versa, if there's a large buyer, a group of buyers wanting to buy Bitcoin at a specific price, there won't be enough liquidity on that particular exchange, and that should then in theory also then push up the price. Lastly, investing can be very emotional. It's very important for emotions not to be part of the equation. Emotion shouldn't be part of the equation, but it always is, unfortunately. When the price drops, people experience FUD, so that's fear, uncertainty, and doubt. They think the price will continue to go down, and they sell. And then the inverse, when the price goes up, people experience something called FOMO, and then that will increase the demand ultimately, and that will increase the price. And I think that is what we saw in 2017 when people experienced FOMO, and the price was driven by greed, and then it rallied up until $20,000.
Decrypto is everything you need to know about buying, trading, and spending cryptocurrency. Brought to you by Luno, only on cliffcentral.com.
Cliffcentral.com.